we do have a quorum. We have with us Senator Schmidt is going to be presenting the Border-to-Border Broadband Development Grant Program bill. Senator Schmidt, if you would like to begin your testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This is an issue that I've been eager to talk about here in the 2014 legislative session, and I'm very pleased to have Senate File 2056 in front of us today. I'll try to keep my remarks brief because we have a fantastic lineup of testimony in front of us, and I know we've got a big agenda in front of this committee today. But let me just start by saying that for the last 10 years, we've seen three separate governor's task forces on broadband in Minnesota. We've identified some goals and some policy recommendations. In fact, we've put speed goals into statute right now. We've seen tremendous activity at the local level and among philanthropies. But unfortunately, Minnesota is just not keeping up, and this is an area of vital infrastructure with a tremendous opportunity for return on investment for driving Minnesota's economy into the future, improving quality of life in much of greater Minnesota. And recently, I embarked upon a modest border-to-border broadband tour, if you will, speaking with about 16 communities throughout Minnesota on this topic. And if we identified any themes or, recommendations from that effort, it's that first and foremost that this is vital infrastructure for the 21st century and that our communities depend upon that kind of connectivity to compete and to attract young families and to really put forth a quality of life in greater Minnesota that they expect to have moving forward. Secondly, there are unique challenges in many of our communities, and we need local solutions to match with those local challenges. And one of the biggest problems facing our communities really comes down to economics. I think our private providers, our cooperatives, our communities themselves would recognize that there's a limited return on investment in many parts of greater Minnesota for infrastructure investments tied to broadband and telecommunications, and that we need to have an infusion of capital to get out to those hard-to-reach areas. And that's what this fund, this Border-to-Border Broadband Fund, intends to do, is to target new resources, both state and hopefully local, to addressing this challenge. And moving the dial and making Minnesota a leader when it comes to broadband investments in infrastructure and the services and applications that ride on that infrastructure. And one last takeaway I took from this round of hearings throughout Minnesota, informal listening session meetings, is that folks are tired of talking about the issue. They want to see action. We've been talking about this for a long time. We've put some goals into statute. It looks like we're going to fall short of those goals. But regardless, we need to have this conversation at the state level, at the legislature. It's high time that we do that. And I view this session as the perfect time to kick off that conversation. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce A1 amendment for folks to consider. It combines a number of technical changes and also clarifies a couple aspects of this bill before you.
Okay. Senator Schmidt, there is a technical amendment to this as well Mr. Fuller is going to explain.
If Mr. Fuller could proceed, I'd welcome that. Mr. Fuller, if you don't mind, and Mr. Chair, would you mind repeating that?
After the first, is there a special revenue fund in the... So, Mr. Chair, what this does is this makes it clear that it's not subject to cancellation. It's dedicated to this purpose as the appropriation section provides.
Okay. Any other questions on that?
If there are no questions, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move both the technical amendment and the A1 in order.
Okay, so Senator Schmidt incorporates the technical amendment into his amendment, and any discussion to the amendment as amended? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is passed. And right. Senator Schmidt.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just take a couple of quick moments here before we get into the testimony on this bill. What the border-to-border broadband fund seeks to do is infuse capital into the hardest-to-serve areas in Minnesota, the markets where we just don't have that, that short-term return on investment that our private providers and our cooperatives are looking for. This fund is not unique. We've seen a number of other states do this. And what we're trying to do is learn the best lessons from those efforts and target our resources accordingly so that we can meet our state broadband speed goals of 10 to 20 megabit per second download and 5 to 10 megabit per second upload by 2015. We'll get into a little bit more information here in our testimony on where we are relative to those. But you can see it, the map to my left here just shows investment in Minnesota at the 25 megabit per second download speed level. And it's a drastic difference between the investment that's made in the metropolitan areas, in our regional centers, and in much of rural Minnesota, in between those areas. And it's no fault of our providers or our cooperatives. This is basic economic, folks. And that's what we're trying to address here with this bill is an infusion of capital to help us extend that infrastructure out to those hard-to-reach areas.
Sure. Thank you, Senator Schmidt. Senator Nelson has a question.
Yes, thank you. I just want to clarify because my mind is swirling around, and really I appreciate you bringing this bill. But my question, I thought our state goal was 10 and 5, but I thought I just heard you say 20. And so as you're giving your testimony and as the folks are testifying, I need to have some clarity around whether it's 10 up and 5 down, I thought was our goal, or whether it's 20. So just
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, it's Senator a great Schmidt. Question. And actually, our state speed goals are 10 to 20 megabits per second download speed and 5 to 10 megabit per second upload speed by 2015. You heard right. It's a range in both cases. And that's what we have on statute. That was came from our first task force report, and we put that into law.
Thank you very much for that clarification.
Yeah, thanks for the question. Sure. And Senator, so what we're looking to do here in Senate File 2056 is create a border-to-border broadband fund that would be funded at the current level of $100 million that would be administered through the deed. And it's a competitive matching grant program that would try to captivate the attention of our local communities, our providers, our cooperatives, ideally to form partnerships at the local and regional level to address the basic challenge here that is a lack of investment in certain parts of rural Minnesota, areas where we're not meeting our state speed goals, in particular areas where we're falling quite short of meeting our state speed goals. What we've done in concert between the original bill and the amended language here is identified two areas. Unserved areas in Minnesota is identified as those areas that are not meeting Federal Communications Commission standards of 4 megabit per second upload and 4 megabit per second download speeds and 1 megabit per second upload speeds, and also underserved areas that are not meeting our state speed goals that we currently referenced. And so those are the areas that we seek to target. We're creating a fund here in Section 2. We get into the eligible expenditures, the eligible applicants. At this stage, we're looking at a number of different applicants. We're trying to incent the formation of partnerships at the local and regional level. And again, this is a competitive matching grant program that would be administered through DEED. And with that said, members, it's a pretty straightforward bill. I would love to get into our testimony here, field any questions you may have. And, of course, I know that the agenda for the committee here is pretty full today, so I want to be respectful of your time as well. Happy to stand for any questions, and God knows I could talk all day about this subject. I'm convinced that this is the item that we should be talking about when it comes to infrastructure investments, and I'm just happy to have the chance to chat today.
Sure. Thank you, Senator Schmidt. And I see a number of testifiers that we have with us today. And should we start with Mr. Rick King? Is he with us today? Mr. King, welcome to the committee. And if you could state your name and position for the record, please.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Name is Rick King. I'm the COO at Thomson Reuters in Eagan.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. King. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members and staff. Thanks for the opportunity to speak before you today in support of Senate File 2056. As I said, I'm the COO for technology at Thomson Reuters, a Minnesota company going back to 1872, currently employer of about 7,000 professional people in Eagan. In addition, I was the chair of the Minnesota Ultra High Speed Broadband Task Force, appointed by our previous governor, that issued a landmark report. If anybody wants a copy of it, I can still produce it for you. I'll be glad to send it to you. This is the one with the speed goals contained within it, might add. So this was issued in October of 2009 about the state of broadband in Minnesota and the proposed goals, which were ultimately passed into law in May of 2010. As was stated here in the clarification, the senator correctly stated the speed goal ranges. The other part of the goal was that Minnesota would be top five states for broadband speed, universally accessible to residents and business across the board. So that is another important piece. The culmination of a dream in 1889 by James Hill led to the creation of the Great Northern Railroad, carrying freight, passengers, and mail across the country, thus creating many opportunities for resource economies and communities to thrive. Fast forward 125 years, access to high-speed broadband to accelerate our modern-day version of the transportation infrastructure is critical to provide tools needed for industries such as for public safety, education, and telemedicine all across Minnesota. Much like the introduction of electricity and the railway commerce, high-speed broadband is a universal facilitator. We will all need access in the future to thrive. In my testimony before the Senate in November of 2009, I said in part, we need to invest in it. It's also good economics. According to the U.S. Department of Commerce study, communities in which mass market broadband were available experienced more rapid growth in employment, the number of businesses overall, and businesses in IT-intensive sectors relative to comparable communities without broadband at that time. Further, as I testified, according to a recent at that time, statewide broadband mapping exercise, 94% of Minnesotans had access to broadband as defined by the FCC at the time. The remaining 6%, or about 97,000 households, or about 300,000 citizens, did not have access. If you look at the same data but use our proposed goals for 2015, only 17% Minnesotans met at that period in time. And I concluded that testimony with, clearly we have a long way to go. Now, if I fast forward to today, as of today, when we include mobile, which is an important factor, which has greatly expanded the availability, 99.8% of Minnesotans have access, leaving about 4,000 unserved, according to the latest analysis by Connect Minnesota. When we look at our minimum goals today, roughly the 10-6 that we discussed, we are 74.5% available, including mobile. So while we've made some progress, we clearly have more progress to do to meet the state goal of universal access at the speed numbers that are in the statute. However, there are still areas in our state, mostly in rural areas of greater Minnesota, along with some spotty patches in our metro area, where availability at our speed goal is non-existent and reaching those households is still a challenge. While the rising tide of technology advancement has lifted all boats to help us get closer to the minimum goal, we are far from making progress to get into the top five in speed and access. The economic data and research is clear that access and use of high-speed broadband grows economies, as I said before, and provides access to markets and develops workforce for the 21st century economy, enabling and enables entrepreneurship. Minnesota simply cannot afford to fall behind our national and global economy as we become more dependent on high-speed broadband for connectivity. Senate File 2056 sets up a framework to establish partnerships and grants to further the objective of the state, meeting the goals established in law. Let me emphasize, it would be my hope that this bill would spur a series of public-private partnerships to help us meet the law's goals. The appropriation of $100 million is something we could not do when our task force met back when we wrote our report. Our state is in a better position to do this today. Now is the time to make the modest investment. I know there will be some other bills that this committee and others will consider in here in the coming days. They will help us, along with Senate Bill 56, which is a 2056, which is a fine start. In closing, I urge you to approve and support Senate File 2056, including an appropriation to help push the state to the goals that are set in our state law. I'm happy to stand for any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Mr. King. Any questions? Okay, seeing none. Thanks again, Mr. King. And the next on the agenda, Margaret Anderson Kelleher. Welcome, Ms.
Anderson
Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, members. Thank you, Senator Schmidt, for authoring the bill. And I spent a little bit of time with you last week talking about the report, and I really appreciate that time. I know the task force appreciates the time as well. This bill specifically is a very important part of the Governor's Broadband Task Force's recommendations this year. And that is because I believe it really signals a move to a real commitment to make sure we are on track to meet these goals, maybe not by 2015, but in the next few years. And I think I shared with you previously that one of the things the task force has learned, and a lot of our first work, I have to compliment Mr. King, was built on that task force report. We went through that and thought about how we should build forward. But one of the very important things to keep in mind here is that we are now talking about parts of the state where without intervention, without partnership, without some money partnering with private dollars, we will reach these goals in a very slow manner. And frankly, it really makes a difference to Minnesotans. And so I just want to share with you that from analysis through the Connect Minnesota numbers, if we were able to at least increase by one percentage point, that one percentage point alone adds $517 million to the Minnesota economy. So as we're able to close this gap between 75% and 100%, you can see that the potential economic return is very high. That combined with some of the numbers by the SNG group, which looks at maximization of use of broadband across the state, particularly for small businesses, we know we can grow that even further. Why is it important? We know for that each percentage point that over 8,000 jobs are saved or created in the state of Minnesota. We know that $387 million of direct income growth happens in the state of Minnesota. We know that $1.7 million of annual health care costs are saved. And we also know that there's time savings to Minnesotans as well. This is not just a quality of life issue anymore. This is about the growth of our state. And one of the things that I just want to help Senator Schmidt with, because I so appreciate his work on the issue and your attention to it, is some people wonder why this fund and why isn't there a great list sitting in front of you of projects today, like a bonding list, for example. And that is because when you think about this issue, you have to think about it like the other funds that you've established in recent years, the Governor's Job Creation Fund, the Minnesota Investment Fund, the Solar Fund that we heard about in the news today, which is oversubscribed already and is going to have to go to lottery. One of the things here is that we won't know the true demand for the level of partnership projects until you put the fund in place. And so that's why I really urge action this year. This is a great issue for one-time dollars. This is not a tail wagging the dog in terms of the budget. This is one-time investment. It can be partnered and multiplied, and it's a perfect fund issue. It will actually bring together partnerships all across the state, and the task force strongly supports the work of Senator Schmidt and Representative Simonson on this issue, the House author, and we hope that you'll find some room in the budget for it. Thank you.
Thank you. And any questions at all? Seeing none.
So, Mr. Chair, if I could interject real quick, with this tight schedule and deadlines looming, I have to be in two places at once right now, and I'm due downstairs in the Transportation Public Safety Committee. I'm not sure what the Chair would like to do in this situation, if you'd like to continue to hear testimony, or if Sarah Coonan is on this bill, if he could sit in my place for the time being. Whatever you like to do is fine with me, but I do have to go present a bill downstairs.
Sure. Senator Dames.
Just one question, Mr. Chair, for Senator Schmidt. Could you tell me $100 million, can you tell me how you arrived at that dollar figure? How'd you come up with that before you leave?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, thank you for the question. That's a number that was identified by the governor's task force, and it's included in their current report. And it should be noted that the governor's task force has been meeting for, I think, 3 years now. And I'm not familiar with the inner machinations of how they arrived at $100 million, but if we take a step back and just look at the magnitude of the problem, that governor's task force report also identified a broadband infrastructure investment gap anywhere of $1 billion to $3 billion. That's the infrastructure investment that's not being made in Minnesota right now. That's what it would take to get us to our state goals. You look at what a $100 million fund could mean if we were able to pair that with local funding, a local match, whether it's public or private, and also leverage additional federal dollars. And then you can really start talking about an impactful contribution to getting at those that infrastructure deficit and meeting our state goals. So I think the magnitude is spot on in my mind. I think we need to have a large fund to get the attention of our stakeholders, of our providers, of our rural cooperatives. But also we need to leverage this amount of capital in order to really to move the dial, to make a significant impact. You look at how much some of these projects cost, and for some communities, $20 million or $30 million for a project is not unheard of. There's a couple of projects that are being talked about in rural Minnesota right now with a price tag around $60 million or more. And so the magnitude of this investment is great, and in my mind, we would be joking ourselves if we were talking about a fund that was significantly less than $100 million. It's going to take a big effort to do this. If you look at similar efforts that have been pursued in other states, $100 million is not inappropriate when you compare them to those efforts.
Thank you,
Senator. So, Mr. Chair, it's a chair's discretion here. If I could excuse myself, and
sure.
Senator Kuhn, if you'd sit in my place, if at any point in the proceedings you'd like to set this aside, I will be back to this committee room this afternoon yet. So.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Schmidt. Yes.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Half the committee's on this bill, so I trust that that the interest is moving this bill out of committee today. So thank you.
You bet. Thank you, Senator Schmidt. Yep, Senator Kuhnen, you want to step forward, and then we'll just continue with the testimony. We do have Mr. Dan Dorman. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Dorman. And if you could state your name for the record and position.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Dorman. I'm the executive director of the Greater Minnesota Partnership. And I appreciate the time that you've allowed, the committee's allowed for us. Committee members should have a couple of handouts, Mr. Chair, if I could go through them briefly and talk about them. So some of you may not be aware of what the partnership is. So if you've got this packet here, it talks a little bit about the partnership, the history of it. The back page of that, Mr. Chair, is the idea of who our board members are and the 10 positions that our board has approved for us to work on. Page 3 of that is the Why Have an Advocacy Group for Greater Minnesota, because we do work primarily exclusively for the benefit of Greater Minnesota. And I think the thing to take away from there as it impacts this particular piece of legislation is Moody's, one of the rating agencies that gives the state its bond rating, in its 2013 report was concerned about the continuing divergence in the economy of the metropolitan and non-metropolitan area, which plays right into the bill before you today. The next page is a membership map showing you where our members are from throughout the state. Our members are listed. Then I'd like to call your attention to this page, which is the survey results. We conducted a survey after a series of 9 regional meetings with elected officials, with nonprofits, and with the business community, and we got all the results back statewide in Greater Minnesota. The number one issue that came up relative to economic development was broadband, and so we have made that our number one issue, Mr. Chair. The second one that you have in your hand is the replication of that map. That map does show the 25 down and 6 up, and the non-shaded areas are counties in the state that have at least 50%, not 100%, but at least 50% of the households that meet that. So it gives you an idea of what the differences are in the state today. Second page of that, Mr. Chair and members, titled Border to Border Broadband Infrastructure Fund. A lot of really good information there about how we have fallen behind or failed to, you know, we're clearly not going to make that number five goal. We're currently number 23rd. It's also a chart on there that shows the difference, depending on the speed you pick, in the metropolitan area versus greater Minnesota. The New York is talked about at the bottom. They're in the top 10, and they have yet invested $68 million, even though they are in the top 10. But probably the last page there, I think, is very interesting, and that's a county-by-county breakdown. So it's this information here of the number of households and the percentage of households that have speeds or access to these speeds. And I think the interesting thing, or a couple of interesting things there caught me when I looked at this, it does a pretty good job of, I think, highlighting the fact that through not really the fault of anybody or any group, but that there's a problem in greater Minnesota that we need to take action to try to reverse this trend and not just talk about it for another 10 years. So you can kind of get a look at the divergence or differences in different counties throughout the state. You know, I was thinking about the question that Senator Nelson asked earlier about, you know, why 25, why not 6, why this? And I think the what I would say is, you know, if four down and one up, or wherever the number you want to choose, if that was really sufficient to meet our needs both today and in the future, then the question would be, why did anybody build out a more robust network anywhere in the state, not just in greater Minnesota? So clearly, I personally think the FCC numbers are very low. I think the state numbers may have made sense in 2009, 10, and 11 when they were formulated, but I think if you start looking over what we need now, what we'll need in the next 10 to 20 years, I think is going to be closer to the speeds that are reflected on that map. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to be here and answer any questions that you or other committee members may have.
Thank you, Mr. Darman. Any questions? Okay, seeing none. Thanks again. And let's see. Next on the list, we have Mr. Kelly Hinnenkamp. Did I pronounce that correctly? Oh, miss. I'm sorry.
Hello, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Yeah, and if you could state your name and position for the record, please.
My name is Kelly Hinnenkamp. I am the city administrator for the city of Annandale and an advocate for the proposed bill, Senate File 2056. Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the city of Annandale is located in western Wright County. We have a population of 3,300, but due to the 26 lakes in a 10-mile radius, the Annandale community has anywhere from 8,000 to 11,000 residents, depending upon the time of year. The community is serviced by a single provider that operates a decaying system plagued by slow speeds and frequent outages, some for multiple days at a time. During outages or times of significant latency, retail businesses cannot process credit cards, medical facilities cannot access patient records or fill prescriptions, schools and students within Annandale cannot participate in opportunities such as online learning, and businesses cannot use or produce technologies that increase efficiencies, leaving our community far from the expectations of the 21st century. With nowhere to turn, the Annandale community looked to the city for a solution. Efforts were made initially to work with the incumbent provider, but unfortunately, there's no incentive for them to upgrade their system or even hold them accountable for the significantly poor quality of service being provided. With the assistance of the Blandon Foundation, the city commissioned a study in the fall of 2013. The goal of this study was to determine the most feasible way to improve service and identify potential partners the city could work with to improve service. We analyzed various technologies and approaches and identified four potential providers that expressed some level of interest in serving Annandale. We're very pleased with the progress we've made, but we've discovered there still is a gap in providing the network that we will know will ensure the needs of our community will be met now and in the future. And the proposed bill has a significant impact on our ability to do that for three reasons. First, the bill will allow for Greater Annandale to be reached, which is a significant part of our community, and our businesses rely on them. Currently, the most cost-effective solution for the private sector is to only serve the city limits and minimal pockets of density around the city. The bill will offset the cost burden and ensure that all of our residents in the community will be reached with broadband service. Second, the fund creates accountability to the private sector, something that we lack significantly in Annandale right now. Without the likelihood of municipal networks, small markets will only see improvements that are good business decisions and not based on what the community need is. And lastly, like all communities in our state, Annandale wants to be in control of our future. We know that our future is dependent on reliable broadband service. It's part of how we live, how we grow and operate our businesses, how we educate our students and provide health care to our residents. This utility has become essential to the quality of life we have in Annandale, and our local leaders need to have the opportunity to be part of the decision when the impact on the future of our community is so significant. We desperately want to have all of these partnerships in Annandale that we're talking about here today. So thank you so much for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hinkamp. Any questions? Seeing none, thanks again.
Thank you.
Next, Jody Reich. Welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jody Reich. I'm a commissioner from Rock County and also a frustrated rural user of broadband. In 2011, my family and I were able to fulfill a lifelong dream of purchasing an acreage just outside the city limits of Laverne. Ever since I can remember, I've always had a dream of either owning a place on a lake or on a hill. Well, since Rock County has no lake, I end up purchasing a place on a hill. Imagine my disappointment. I work out of my home. I work for a major insurance company based on the East Coast. I've had a home-based office for the past 20-plus years. Foolishly, when we purchased this acreage, I did not even think to ask about broadband service. You can literally see the city limits from my front steps. I just took it for granted that everyone in Greater Minnesota, or at least Rock County, had adequate broadband connections. Almost immediately after moving into our new home, I found out the internet service was going to be an issue. The problem was that the current satellite providers all had data caps, and as luck would have it, I was able to assumed the contract from the current resident and was able to get service through Clearwave. Why this is important, Clearwave at the time had unlimited data, so there was no data caps. While they were unlimited, the service was very slow, unreliable, but still affordable. In December of 2013, Verizon, who now owns Clearwave, sent out notice that they were no longer to offer service to Clearwave customers. They gave us a few options, but all which were more costly and had data caps. In checking the marketplace, I soon learned that my options were limited. Keep in mind, again, I live less than 1 mile from the city limits. The current satellite providers all have data caps, latency issues, and are very expensive. Verizon will let you purchase additional usage, and while other carriers will simply slow down your service after you have reached the data caps. When I called them to discuss my options, they had a solution. They said, that's not a problem. We'll have unlimited usage from the hours of midnight to 5 a.m. While this may be ideal for getting work done, it does little to support the family life. The other issue some of the current providers have what's called phantom usage. So here's how this works. They put data caps, and then even while you're not in your home or using your broadband, you're still getting there's draws happening to your data usage. And when I was doing some research again, I went and was just kind of checking consumer reviews, and that's probably what the number one complaint is. It's one thing to pay for the usage, but then to still be used, charged for the usage is very frustrating. So we went from being able to use it to now, the number one complaint I hear from rural broadband users is they now had to turn into almost policemen of their own home. For example, everybody that is using broadband through a satellite system, they have a monthly usage. And when you go over that usage, the bills grow exponentially. For example, many of the families that I've visited with, it is nothing to see bills well in excess of $200 if you do go over the data caps. Times have changed over the last 20-plus years. My company is a company of just over 4,500 employees nationwide. We have just under 1,900 employees that work out of their homes. I'm thinking this is more the norm than in the past. We are, as secured users or remote users, are expected to log into a secured network, or VPN. My conference meetings now are held over the internet. Where I used to once fly to a meeting and be gone 2 or 3 days, I'd spend hundreds of dollars and many days gone from the home. I now just log in and have a productive business day. It's also changed in how I've got two teenage boys. My kids no longer take textbooks home. They log into the school's website. They pull their assignments up. They communicate with their teachers after school hours. And they also turn their assignments in. Entertainment has also changed. You know, the other day I was talking to my kids. I'm like, hey, why don't you go hang out with your buddies? And they're like, Dad, we are. And I said, what do you mean? Well, they're online gaming. Kids nowadays, they dial into whatever the current game is, and they got these headsets, and they're talking to their friends, and it's how they communicate nowadays. Also, they order movies from Netflix. We have a foreign exchange student living with us right now, and he's Skyping back home into Germany. I guess in closing, I'd like to say that as a commissioner of Rock County, we support any support that you could provide the state in moving forward with the broadband initiatives. Rock County is shovel ready. We are looking to put some sort of funds at a county level into this. And that should be show great support. As you know, most commissioners don't like to spend any money. So we do realize, though, listening to our constituents, that this is a large need. In closing, I'd like to thank you for listening to my story and for supporting the broadband bill that is currently in front of you. I do believe that every Minnesota resident will benefit from this. Broadband infrastructure will provide level playing fields for greater Minnesota, which in turn stimulates our economy and further strengthens our quality of life. Thank you.
Thank you. And are there any questions at all? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Mr. Reich. And we have next Mr. Gary Evans. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Evans, and if you could state your name and position for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee and staff. I'm Gary Evans, retired president and CEO of Hiawatha Broadband Communications in Winona, a member of the Governor's Broadband Task Force, and also the chair of the board of the Greater Minnesota Partnership. I'm currently serving as interim vice president of advancement at Winona State and executive director of its foundation. You've heard today about a very special piece of legislation, Senate File 2056. This bill is extremely important, and I join my colleagues in urging its passage. This issue, Senator, is not about incumbents versus competitors. It's not about municipalities versus private enterprise. It's not about big versus little or communities that win or lose. The issue today is about putting Minnesota into the broadband game. Our state has a proud history of leading, not lagging. It is led in education. The rural electrification movement started here. It's known as a great place to live. but it has not led in broadband. In fact, its current status of 23rd in the nation is disappointing because I hate to see Minnesota in the middle of the pack in anything, especially when the United States is hardly in contention in the broadband race with other industrialized nations. I know there are questions about why this bill is important and how it fits with the list of things on which to spend money. Let me share with you the words penned yesterday by John Capanelli in the Cleveland Business Journal. I quote, "The mayor of Duluth jumped into Lake Superior in the middle of winter. The mayor of Sarasota, Florida, waded into a tank with sharks. The mayor of Topeka, Kansas, signed a proclamation renaming his city Google for a month. Other cities tried different stunts, flash mobs, videos, celebrities. Portland brewed a gigabit pale ale, and Madison, Wisconsin created Google ice cream. It was all an attempt to convince the tech giant to bring its ultra-high-speed internet, Google Fiber, to town. In the end, Kansas City was chosen to become the petri dish for the service, which offers online speeds of 1 gigabit a second, more than 100 times faster than the average U.S. broadband connection. In the 3 years since the announcement, Google has wired dozens of fiber hoods in Kansas City and is offering service for $70 a month. Last year, Austin, Texas, and Provo, Utah were announced as the next cities to get the service. And last month, 34 others, including Atlanta, Portland, and San Jose, were told they might get the service. As embarrassing as it was, the Google wooing by cities makes complete sense. What canals and railroads meant to the 19th century and what highways and airports meant to the 20th century, ultra-high-speed broadband will mean to the 21st. This is the infrastructure that will light the fuse of economic growth. It's already happening in Kansas City. Businesses are moving into areas with fiber. Property values are rising, and competing internet services are upping their speeds without raising prices." End quote. So this is all about tomorrow and Minnesota's competitiveness. It's about creating partnerships to get the job done. It's about all providers playing roles here. Every time Kansas City gains a business, Minnesota loses an opportunity. Every time Kansas City gains a new telecommuter, Minnesota loses a potential resident. To make our state competitive, I believe a bold step is needed. Senate File 2056 promotes such a bold step. It is my hope that you will use your vote to help Minnesota move ahead in preparing itself for growth and prosperity in the 21st century. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from Ms. Travis?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to make a comment thank you, Mr. Evans, for making. I was taking comparison to Kansas. I'm a former resident of Kansas myself, and the reason I move up here because the progressiveness of this state, and I like what you mentioned, called it the bold step. So let's make that happen. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Oh, next, we do have further testimony from Mr. Brent Christensen.
Brought a prop. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen, and I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, a trade association that represents 46 independent telecommunications carriers. Our members support the concept of a broadband fund and grant and loan program. And let me just be clear that we're not the ones bringing this proposal forward. As previously stated, this came from the governor's broadband task force, and we support their efforts. We've been working with Senator Schmidt and very much appreciate his leadership on this issue. I'm here to advocate for those areas of the state that are truly underserved, like Commissioner Reich talked about. Senator Schmidt has talked about them before, the rural parts of our state that are a mile or more outside of city limits, where there just isn't any way to recover the cost of installation and monthly service revenues. We believe that any fund or program must be directed at the hardest areas to serve first. All Minnesotans must have access to the information highway before we were about getting some driving Cadillacs. The testifier from Annandale, that story is actually sadder than it sounds. They used to have a private provider in that town, and that was sold to a company that doesn't have any presence in Minnesota. So while that is a story, and it's sad, and it needs to be addressed, they do have four proposals to get them infrastructure and to get them the services that they need without any money available or needed from the state. There's a lot of discussion in this committee about broadband speeds. We talked about this last week when I was here, and then I thought it would be make sense to talk about it now with this bill and potential fund. The poster shows the broadband availability at different tier speeds, and as you can see, we have met or exceeded the state's broadband goal and download speeds, and we're only 2 megabits per second away from the upload speed goal. I don't know about you, but I can't tell the difference between 3 megabits and 5 megabits when I upload something to the internet. I'm not talking about getting Netflix. That's the download speeds. And while this is good news, it is no way intended to insinuate that we are done. Broadband speeds are ever increasing as customer needs increase. And saying we've reached our goal and are done is just as wrong as saying that you can future-proof a telecommunications network. Our networks continue to evolve to meet customer needs, which is evident by the fact that speeds continue to increase with no assistance from the state. If we're going to truly get to the unserved areas of Minnesota, providers are going to need some help. This bill could be one of the tools, along with the sales tax exemption on capital equipment, that we need to help to serve the hardest areas. I appreciate your consideration, and I would be happy to stand for any questions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thanks again, Mr. Christensen. And next we have Mr. Mike Martin. Welcome to the committee. And if you could state your name and position, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Martin. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. The MCCA is a trade association of traditional cable companies in Minnesota. They provide voice, video, and high-speed broadband services to hundreds of thousands of homes in Minnesota. I'm proud to say that since 2006, those same companies have invested more than $1 billion to upgrade and improve the broadband services that they're now providing. I also want to thank Senator Schmidt. He's been very willing to work with us and listen to some of our concerns in regard to this legislation. Also, at the outset, I want to state that we certainly recognize that the purpose of the broadband fund is to facilitate expansion of broadband services into those areas in Minnesota where the market has failed. As Mr. Christensen said, there's areas in the state where it is simply unfeasible. Private companies doing business have been unable to operate in those areas. And the purpose of this fund, we see the purpose of this fund to facilitate the expansion of those services into those areas. Our concern with the bill is that there's not enough focus on unserved. The way the bill is currently written, the department is going to have the discretion to provide either services to unserved as defined in the bill or to underserved. And we feel that the priority, the sole priority of the bill at this point, with the state just getting into providing this kind of support, should be those areas that are truly unserved. It seems to us that students that go home at night with an iPad provided by their school that are unable to get anything but a dial-up service live in areas that should be targeted for this purpose. But the bill doesn't say that. The bill gives wide latitude, wide discretion to the department in where that assistance can be provided. We think that's a mistake, and that the focus should be on unserved areas. You know, in Minnesota, under the terms of the underserved definition, a community that is getting broadband service at 100 by 3, which means 100 megabits down and 3 up, would not meet the state goals, would be considered underserved, and would be eligible for state assistance. I think it would be a huge omission if an area so served qualified for state assistance, while areas unserved or with dial-up would have to wait. And that basically is our essential concern with this. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Martin? Okay, I see none. Thank you for your testimony. Okay. And Ms. Abby Bryduck?
Yes. Hi, thank you.
Welcome
for your time.
To the committee.
Yes, thank you. My name is Abby Bryduck. I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I want to be brief. I know you've heard a lot of testimony, but I just want to share with you that this is an issue that's really percolating up through our association as a priority, and especially for areas in rural Minnesota for access. And in fact, I primarily work on transportation issues, but we've sort of restructured some of our issues so that broadband infrastructure is considered an infrastructure issue like roads and bridges. And I think some people could make the argument that, and actually has been, that in this century, this broadband infrastructure is almost as important as and roads and bridges of the last century. So we look forward to some of the opportunities that this bill and this grant program might provide for us. And so we just want to let you know that we're in support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bryduck. Any questions at all? Yes, Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I have some comments that relate to the bill in general.
Sure.
Are you ready for those now?
Sure.
Or do you have more testifiers?
Well, that was the last one on our list. Is there anyone else who would like to testify that we didn't have on the list? Okay. See none. Go ahead, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this has been a great discussion, and I am so committed to high-speed broadband access. I do realize it is the absolute infrastructure that's needed in our society right now, whether it be for education, economic development, telemedicine. So much of what we do relies on having that high-speed broadband or wireless access. And so today I noticed for the first time the word disparities here. And I think that's an important thing for us to keep in mind, because Minnesota, unfortunately, is known as a state with great disparities. We have the worst education disparities in the nation. We have significant health disparities and disparities with housing. And so we want to be really thoughtful as we move forward with this broadband proposal. And I have two lines of concerns that I'm hoping that we can make sure that this important initiative addresses. And one of them has to do with somewhat what Mr. Martin spoke about, which is the analysis of where are we going to put those dollars. I'll give you an example of my county. We talked about this clear last year. Olmsted County. Olmsted County, when we were shown the map in 2013, it showed that it would only 20% of the households had broadband access. And you'll remember I sat in committee and said, that's wrong. Those are wrong numbers. I know that. I don't know what they're based on, but they're wrong numbers. And now the newer map that we got today or last week showed 30% of Olmsted County was underserved. And yet, here are the numbers, and I ask you, is this being underserved? 92% of the households in Olmsted County are served by Charter Communications. 92% of the households in Olmsted County are served by Charter Communications. Those speeds are 100 down and 5 up. And so my concern is that by not having the accurate numbers and doing a real needs analysis, we are going to put public funds in the areas that do not have the greatest need. And as a public servant, I think our job is to make sure that we address where the needs are the greatest and make sure that we put our funds there. So that's one thing that I'd like to make sure that we are very cognizant of going forward. And the second issue that I have not adequately heard addressed yet, and that is that I can't tell from this legislation that there's anything in here that would prevent municipalities, nonprofits, non-taxpaying entities from qualifying for these grants. And if you think about it, that is, they have a tax non-tax advantage to the businesses that do pay taxes that actually allow us to do things like do broadband grants and other state expenditures. And so my hope is that we can actually focus these dollars in the areas of greatest need, those places where there's just not a return on investment for private business to come in and do that last mile or the last miles, and to provide these grants to those private businesses, those tax-paying businesses. So now, while the ROI doesn't support getting broadband to the to all of our communities and Minnesotans, I think this is the role of government to provide for those last miles, those last areas where the ROI isn't there. And so that's what I'm hoping that the bill will continue to do. And I've heard I haven't heard that those two issues have been addressed yet, and I'm very concerned about that. And I'm just wondering, while I think it's so important that we get this right, we don't want to invest $100 million and end up with the greatest disparities. And so I think it's real important that we do it correctly. And I'm not sure where the $100 million came from. It kind of goes back to those numbers and that needs analysis. And I just think it would be so helpful if we had and maybe someone on the task force has that, an actual needs analysis of how many places can get no service at all. And let's focus on that. And I'm wondering if those things can't be addressed today, maybe we should lay this bill over until we get those things addressed so that going forward, we know that the dollars are actually going to help those who don't have access, instead of allowing unfair competition in areas that already have access.
Okay. Senator Schmidt, you want to respond?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, I appreciate your thoughtful commentary here. And you know, I've really enjoyed working with industry on this bill. I think that we see that this is an opportunity to address a shared concern and really focusing on the driving factor that's behind these disparities in Minnesota, and that's the basic economics, the basic funding behind this, the lack of capital. And I'm very optimistic that, and I'm quite convinced that this is the solution to really move the dial in Minnesota to help us meet our state broadband goals. We've met consistently, and I plan on continuing to meet with industry. And I got to tell you, I'll say this again, if this doesn't work for the folks who are doing the great work in greater Minnesota, providing the service, our cooperatives, our private providers, then it doesn't work for me, it doesn't work for Minnesota. So we have to continue to have that dialogue, and I'm committed to improving this bill every stop of the way. But I would say my reading of the bill in the way I talk, when I'll say this right here in committee, we have to target the places of greatest need first and foremost, and I think that's spelled out in this bill. But it's also important for us to recognize that we have state goals on statute right now. And you heard testimony today, at least 25% of the state, we're not meeting those right now. And what we want to do with this fund is we want to put in place a mechanism and tools for getting Minnesota to meet those goals in every corner of the state. because that's how we move the dial on being a leader in broadband. That's what puts us in the top five. That's what allows us to meet our state goals, if not by 2015, then as fast as we possibly can. And Senator Nelson, if I could just reiterate, I think that you and I share a goal for what we want to see happen with this fund, and I want to make it work for our providers and cooperatives, the folks who are doing this work. So I look forward to those continued conversations. And at this stage in the game, I feel very good with what we brought to this committee, and I would urge a vote and passage of this bill in committee here today.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the follow-up. And you're correct, Senator Schmidt. This is a much better bill than what we saw before. But can you tell me where does it – you could probably alleviate one of my great concerns right now. Where does it say in here – what would prohibit some of these grants from going to going to Rochester, or which has 92% of its households already served – by a taxpaying entity. So what in here would ensure that these grants would go to those places that really don't have access because the ROI just isn't there?
And Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, if I could direct your attention to Subdivision 6 awarding grants, we have amended language here. And what we're looking at doing is elevating first and foremost above all other criteria that DEED would consider is that in evaluating applications and awarding grants and loans, the commissioner shall give priority to applications that are constructed in areas identified by the Director of Office of Broadband Development as unserved. Those are the areas that currently, by FCC definition, lack access to 4 megabit per second download speed, 1 megabit per second upload speed. That's the area of greatest need in Minnesota, and that's what we identify first and foremost in the amended language. And it's there for a reason, Senator.
Thank you. And okay. Just one last
Senator
follow-up.
Nelson.
So are these in itemized then in order of importance? Because there's about there's quite a few ways of awarding grants here. I think 9, maybe 10 different ways to award
Mr.
grants.
Mr. Chair and Senator, if I could just tell you, that's the only one that we have used the shell language and directed the Office of Broadband Development and the Commissioner of Deed. That Commissioner shall consider the areas that are unserved first and foremost. And it's a priority for us. This is the way we've talked about it at every step of the way, and I'll maintain that today.
Might I add an amendment then? That we just put in those great words, first and foremost. So on line 3.9, or maybe I can have one of our administrators help me with that exact language, but I'd like to capture that language, Senator Schmidt, and just get that in the bill then. We shall give great priority to – we shall give first and foremost priority to applications that – So I guess I'd make that oral amendment, 3.8, line 3.8.
Mr. Chair and members,
Senator Schmidt.
If I could, Senator Nelson, I appreciate your commitment to improving this bill as you see it.
Yes.
I think we have a great relationship with industry, and I just as soon have these conversations between committee stops. I've spoken to members of this committee. I believe that this bill is in pretty darn good shape right now, and I would ask folks not to consider any additional amendments, but let's continue this conversation, move the bill forward, and pass it out today without any additional amendments. So I would speak against any oral amendments at this time. I'm happy to consider improvements along the way, but I think this bill is in the shape that we want it to be in today.
And, Senator Nelson, would you be amenable to that working after the committee work here today?
I would, but I'm a little confused because I'm using the exact words that you said, and so I would like to make that amendment.
Okay.
So, evaluating applications and awarding grants, the commissioner shall give first and foremost priority to applications that, and then that would be just point one, and then I imagine you'd have to insert some language between 3.10 and 3.11.
The page and line amendment that was already passed did amend that language.
Does it say first and foremost?
No, it does not say that.
That's what I'd like to see is first and foremost. And maybe Mr. Fuller can give the exact oral amendment that will accomplish that.
And Mr. Fuller, give you some time.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, I think you stated on three, if that's what you want to do,
yes,
add first and foremost.
But it must only apply to subdivision 6.1, which is
right. Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, if you look at the page and line amendment, as Senator Schmidt stated, we now it's been broken into two areas of, one's a shell, which is these unserved areas, and the other one now is the underserved and unserved, which is a may give priority. So in a sense, the bill already says first and foremost.
Yes, yes. So,
Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted that clarification, and I must not have had that exact amendment in front of me. I think we've made it very well clear that that's the legislative intent and the author's intent, and so I'll certainly withdraw my amendment and save the committee some time and feel that that need is addressed between shall and may. So thank
Sounds
you.
Sounds good. Thank you, Senator Nelson. So, Senator Weber.
Just to follow up on a point that Senator Nelson had previously made, are the numbers that shall determine the areas of being unserved or underserved already established, or will we continue to try and refine those numbers and determine and ensure that those numbers are reliable? Her point being that there are some areas that are well-served, and yet on the maps that she had seen, she felt that was not properly stated. So where are we going with that element?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Weber, it's a great question, and I think that's why I try to focus on the applications and what we do with the infrastructure and service that we have available. I think everybody here would say that with technology investments and just the demand for bandwidth, there is a bit of a moving goalpost. And I want to be sensitive to that because we have to make sure that the investments we're making are for the long term and that they not only meet the needs of today, but the needs of tomorrow. And that's what we try to chart out here in this legislation. And so what I would say is, if I could reiterate it again, that we really want to focus on the areas of most need. We want to meet our current state goals that are in statute right now. I think it's clear that goals may change over time, but what we want to do is prioritize the areas of greatest need, and that's why I always try to be consistent with where we're directing our scarce resources in trying to make the initial investments and move that dial accordingly. So I hear what you're saying, and I would say it's difficult. You look at the mapping that we have out there, and I hear from folks on both sides. You know, Senator Nelson may feel as though Olmsted County is not accurately portrayed in the mapping. Every one of the stops I had on our broadband listening tour said that the mapping was flawed as well. And I think that's no criticism of the mapping, the folks who are putting it together, of the providers who are providing the information. I think it is, to a certain extent, an inexact science. But we have a very clear understanding that there are great areas of rural Minnesota that lack access to broadband, and we can do something about that. And that's what this conversation is about, trying to zero in on where those areas are and what's the best policy tool to address those shortcomings in infrastructure.
Okay. Senator Weber.
One last thought, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand what you're saying, Senator, but let's also admit to the fact that government has well known to take money and put it into areas that they maybe shouldn't be putting it. And I think that is, you know, that's the point I'm trying to make here. Let's not be this is a major investment, and let's ensure that we are actually getting it where it needs to be, because we do fail way too often in that respect.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Senator, point
Schmidt.
Well taken. I couldn't agree more.
Thank you. Any other discussion at all here?
So, Mr. Chair, if there's no other
Senator
discussion,
Schmidt.
I'd love to move a vote and a passage of Senate File 2056 today. I appreciate the discussion among the committee members, and I'm very very encouraged by what this bill can mean for greater Minnesota and access to Internet throughout the state.
Great. Well, there's been great testimony on the bill today, and thank you for bringing it forward. With that, Senator Schmidt moves that Senate File 2056 be recommended to pass as amended and referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails and the bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Senator Schmidt.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Senator Dames, would you take the gavel?
I'm going to leave. I have to go to the car.
The concept is right. We do need to get places where there's no return on investment. So we do need to get for miles, whatever that
is. Yeah, I think.
I have a minute.
They're going to reach a resolution today? The answer I've got is
not here. We have the chair, the vice chair, and Senator Dames as authors of this bill. What do you think? It should be a pretty easy one. Yeah.
Yeah, you can go ahead. No.
Right thing. Senator Eakin, are you ready to present Senate File 2221?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair. Senate File 2221, this is actually the chief author is Senator Sparks, who couldn't be with us today. But this bill represents the consensus recommendations for the drainage work group. And you should have a handout in your packets with the information on the work group, which includes all the relevant stakeholder organizations. Their work is facilitated by Bowser, and a lot of time and effort went into finding consensus on these provisions. And I have with me today Al Keen, who is the chief engineer at Bowser, and he can run through the bill for us to explain the changes and answer any detailed questions members may have.
Thank you, Senator Eakin. Mr. Keene, if you would state your name for the record and go forward with your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Al Keene. I serve as chief engineer for the Board of Water and Soil Resources and also serve as a facilitator for the stakeholder drainage work group. And as Senator Eakin indicated, the work group has been working on consensus recommendations. This is actually the fourth set of consensus recommendations for the work group since 2006. The work group has been working together since then to foster science-based mutual understandings about drainage topics and issues, and also to develop consensus recommendations regarding drainage management and other provisions of drainage law and other parts of law. And as Senator Eakin indicated, in your packets there should be a fact sheet about the work group listing all of the different drainage authorities, farm groups, environmental groups, other associations, and state agencies who are participate on the drainage work group. And we also have legislative staff who help us as well. And just to point out again that this is a consensus-based group and that the authority for Bowser to facilitate it was passed by the legislature in recent years. It's in Section 103B, 101, sub 13. And as I indicated in my beginning comments, this is the fourth set of consensus recommendations by the work group. On the back of that fact sheet are the previous three sets of recommendations in summary form if you have an interest in looking into those for detail. I would like to then just go forward with an overview of the recommendations in Senate File 2221. There are four key elements. If you look on, I believe, another handout in your packet is dated 2/14/14, and that is the consensus recommendations with explanations and a summary of those. And I will run through a summary and then open it for questions for you to ask if you will. The first part of this bill is looking at updating Section 103E. 0.015 subdivision 1, which is environmental and land use criteria for consideration by drainage authorities before drainage projects are done. That involves establishment, improvement, projects. And we, as the work group, we're trying to update and clarify those criteria. They were first enacted into law in 1973. And they were last updated in 1987. So our objective for Subdivision 1 was to update and clarify, bringing in some current recommendations regarding wetlands, which has been something that we have in the state put more emphasis on since these criteria were last updated in 1987. So that's part of the update. We're trying to also provide for a better definition of some of the alternative measures that might be looked at, the multiple purposes that water management is looking to do in our state, and trying to update then the language in Subdivision 1 to better address some of those criteria in the current way that we refer to them. Subdivision 1A is a new subdivision recommended to enable a better connection between an authority that was put into drainage law in the year 2000. It's in Section 103E011, Subdivision 5, which enables the drainage authority to use external sources of funding for certain types of activities, including wetland restoration and protection, water quality improvements, and flood control. And so in Subdivision 1A, we're trying to better make that connection to help enable integration of public and private funds for multiple purposes of water management. And within that subdivision, we have reference to local water planning authorities as folks who do have knowledge about different programs and opportunities for public funding that does address some of the public objectives of water management in the state of Minnesota. And we also have a reference to enabling drainage authorities to request such information from the Board of Water and Soil Resources if they choose to. Within Subdivision 2 of 103E015, we're doing just proposing a couple of minor tweaks. One of those is to re-clarify that it does apply to repair projects. The language actually does do that as it stands, but it's not as clear as it could be or as it once was, because during recodification, the word repair had been removed, and we're proposing to add that back, and also proposing to add wetlands as one of the natural resources that are considered in Subdivision 2. The remainder of the bill has updates of other sections in Chapter 103E that refer to Section 103E015, Subdivision 1. Again, the criteria that are to be considered for drainage projects within drainage law. So I believe that I can safely say that while this has been a little bit of a challenge for the drainage work group to find consensus on these proposed recommendations, we ultimately were able to do that. And what is in Senate File 2221 reflects the consensus recommendations of the drainage work group. With that, I will answer any questions that I might.
Thank you, Mr. Kane. Members have any questions? Senator Weber.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. If we go to Subdivision 2 and we add and talk about adding the word repair back in there, I guess as I look at that, obviously the repair can be very minor, it can be fairly major. If it's too major, you basically have a reconstruction and you wind up with a redetermination of benefits and that type of thing in a ditch project. I guess what I'm concerned is this language, is there a strike point at which this becomes effective, or are they going to have to bring every little repair that comes down the pike in front of you at that point?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, recognize too that within drainage law, the definition of repair, which actually was updated a little bit last year through a work group bill that the legislature had passed, it does focus on maintaining the existing capacity of that system. So anything that would look to increase the capacity in accordance with drainage law would be considered an improvement. And therefore, it's a drainage project by definition, and it would, therefore, Subdivision 1 would apply. Subdivision 2 still applies in terms of defining the public utility benefit and welfare. Another piece of information that might be helpful to you, too, is that Subdivision 2 was actually the first part of Section 103E015 that was enacted by the legislature back in 1955. So that consideration of the definition of public welfare and benefit was an early part of adding to drainage law, and then Subdivision 1 with the environmental and land use considerations was added first in 1973 and then amended again a little bit in 1987. So I believe that the drainage law has a fairly good definition of what does and doesn't qualify as a repair.
Okay.
And Subdivision 2 actually in the existing language, because it says that it applies to other work affecting a public drainage system under any law, it really did refer to repair already. And as we understand it, when the law was recodified, a reviser felt that that was a duplication. But now we're thinking, well, this is something that there has been some question about, and adding the word repair back in doesn't change the effect. It just changes the clarity.
Other questions? Other members have questions? Senator Coonan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Keene, is that pronunciation?
Keene, thank you.
Keene, thank you. You know, drainage, if you go back into the 50s, say, was mostly digging a ditch, and you might have a few tile lines. Nowadays, when you talk about a drainage project, a lot of time it includes pattering tiling, or that would maybe be the whole project as far as new drainage goes. Is there, you know, to look at all of this, is there anything in here that might put those kind of projects, if not at risk, at least be more cumbersome to get done? Or does all of this really doesn't affect how pattern tiling is done now?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, these provisions apply to what is called a drainage project, defined in drainage law as an establishment, an improvement of an outlet, and therefore doesn't apply to what I believe you're speaking of, which is private pattern tile in a farmer's field that it may empty into a public drainage system, but these provisions do not apply to that. They apply to the publicly administered drainage system itself, ditch, or if there are public tile, which typically are laterals to a ditch system, not pattern tile.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions from the members? Are there other testifiers that would like to testify on behalf of this bill, Senate File 2221? Hearing none, Senator Eakin, would you like to move your bill and send it to the floor?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move that it be recommended to pass.
Senator Eakin has moved to recommend passage and send the bill to the floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion carries. The bill will be sent to the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Senator Marty, you're up next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I have the Senate File 36, and if this is the first committee, and if the committee is willing, I'd love to have somebody offer the delete everything A14 amendment, and then after that, the A1 amendment to that delete everything amendment.
Okay.
Offer the A14.
Senator Nelson moves the A14 delete all amendment.
You should probably read the whole number.
And it is the A14-0810 amendment. Delete all. And there's also an amendment to that, the A1. The A1 amendment. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Nelson will also move the A1 amendment. I guess we should move the delete all first.
Actually, Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson can just incorporate the A1 into the A14-0810 amendment, and then that way it'll be reflected. It'll be an author's amendment with everything incorporated. Okay.
Yes,
okay.
I would incorporate the A1 into the A14 and offer that.
Senator Nelson incorporates the A1 into the A14 amendment. And let's see, this is first stop. So, does that have so again, this is the first stop for the bill. So this is just to get the bill in the shape and form that the author would like. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment as amended is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And I'll be brief, and I know there are a number of people who wanted to speak. I think most of them are going to be very brief as well. This bill, as those of you who have been on the committee for a number of years know, has been around for a good number of years now. And as of the last year, I think there's been a group that's included veterinarians, Board of Animal Health, animal advocates, breeders, and others working together to try and come up with a compromise on how to address this issue. And this bill, as reflected in the A14 and the A1 amendment incorporated into that, reflects the compromise we've tried to do to address the issue. And basically, larger breeders would be covered. That's people who have facilities who have 10 or more adult intact animals, produce more than 5 total litters of puppies or kittens a year. We're dealing only with dogs and cats. And the problems here, I think a lot of you, I think in the packet has photos of some of the situations we face that we'd like to have addressed. I think the one thing I'd say real briefly about the bill, about the issue, is that our animal cruelty laws are based on complaints. And we're trying to get ahead of the curve and have preventive regulation in place so that this would be, and this is something that it's been a long fought out compromise to try and come to this, but it's something that we would have, those commercial breeders would be licensed and inspected, and we think we will prevent some of the problems that you'll see in those pictures. And again, some have argued, well, the USDA inspects some breeders, but 3 of the large recent animal cruelty cases were all, one in Dakota County, one in Cass, and one in Otter Tail, they were all inspected, licensed and inspected by USDA. One of them had over 1,000 dogs in it. Multiple complaints filed with the USDA, and yet they continued to get their licenses renewed. So if people say, well, they're already being regulated. Minnesota is the one that has the animal cruelty laws we're trying to make sure are enforced. I'd be happy to stand for questions, but perhaps you'd like to take the witnesses first and be happy at any point to take questions.
Sure. We can take the witnesses next. And we have first on the list Ms. Michelle Leba. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Leba. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you. I will try to keep my remarks brief. My name is Michelle Leba, and I am here today to testify as a consumer in support of Senate File 36. My husband and I purchased 2 puppies, a beagle and a rat terrier, at a pet store in Ramsey, Minnesota, through a breeder that was USDA licensed and inspected. Having just been through the heartbreaking task of putting our 11-year-old dog to sleep who had lymphoma, we were delighted to have 2 new additions to our household. We named the beagle Molly Joe and the rat terrier Fritz Patrick. We brought them to our veterinarian the next day for a checkup and to show off our new family members. Our happiness soon became concern and sadness when Molly was diagnosed with an ear infection, coccidia, and kennel cough. Fritz also had coccidia and kennel cough. Coccidia is a parasitic infection that caused them both to have diarrhea for weeks and weeks, which, as you can imagine, was difficult to deal with when trying to house train 2 puppies. Kennel cough is a respiratory infection which caused them to be very tired and lethargic. After several rounds of antibiotics and fecal testing, our puppies were finally rid of the coccidia and kennel cough, and they could start playing and feeling good like normal puppies should. Approximately 6 months after we purchased the puppies, Fritz began having seizures. It was absolutely horrifying. I can't even begin to describe the pain and fear as you watch your pet's whole body go into convulsions, watching foam come out of their mouth, and then sitting there for up to 30 minutes while they lay there unable to walk. He had 6 seizures over 2 months. He underwent extensive testing and was eventually diagnosed with epilepsy. Fortunately, my husband and I had the financial resources to deal with the costs of Molly and Fritz's medical conditions, which to date have totaled over $5,000. Many other consumers would have had to resort to putting their dog to sleep. As I did further research on breeders in Minnesota, I couldn't believe that they are not licensed or inspected ever by a state agency. Due to this lack of oversight, many consumers like myself have purchased unhealthy puppies. Licensing and inspections are the legal means to hold businesses accountable. I believe that our pets deserve the protection that Senate File 36 provides, as do consumers. Thank you for your time and consideration. I urge your support of this very important bill.
Thank you, Ms. Leba. Any questions for Ms. Leba? Seeing none, thank you very much. Next, we have Mr. Keith Streff. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Streff. If you could state your name and position for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I appreciate the opportunity to present in front of you today. My name is Keith Streff, and I'm the senior humane agent for the Animal Humane Society based in Golden Valley. I have been employed at the Animal Humane Society since 1987, and I have a long history of farming and animal biology and criminal justice, as well as a police background and a licensed peace officer that works on a part-time basis in southwestern Minnesota. And I have a pretty broad degree of experience in this particular field. The Animal Humane Society is the largest animal humane society in the upper Midwest. And I'm here today to speak in strong support of Senate File 36. As a humane agent, one of my responsibilities is to respond to citizen complaints regarding animals that are subject to situations and conditions alleged to be in violation of the Animal Welfare Chapter. I'm sure you've all heard and read and seen some of the horrific animal neglect cases that have occurred over the years on the media. Some of those photographs are in front of you today. In many of those cases, I've led the investigation. These cases oftentimes include dozens, sometimes hundreds of dogs. Some are stacked in cages, some run loose, some are left to breed indiscriminately. Some are sick, some injured, some diseased, some dying, and some dead. Improper isolation, feed, water, sanitation, ventilation, and treatment resulting in untreated sores, rotting teeth, blindness, maggot-infested coats, overgrown nails, psychotic behavior, the list goes on. I've witnessed dogs fed roadkill, amateur practice C-sections, and or whatever else is necessary to make sure that there's puppies always available for sale, and that's what drives this industry. Some of these environments required hazard material suits simply because without them you couldn't enter and sometimes breathe due to the staggering amount of excrement, odor, and potential pathogen. Mr. Chair and committee members, Minnesota currently does not have any language in state law that specifically regulates commercial dog breeding and cat breeding facilities. There's no required inspections. There's no current licensing program. Senate File 36 provides regulation, which is preventative. Inspecting and then addressing problem situations in breeding facilities before they escalate to where the animals need to be seized. Existing law only allows me or other local law enforcement agencies respond after a complaint is filed. And it's been my professional experience that it's typically too late. Oftentimes these conditions are so acute there are few options available. Senate File 36 will allow the Board of Animal Health to identify, to correct, and prevent these catastrophic environments before they develop. Uniform statewide regulation will save local municipalities and law enforcement money in the long term. For example, take these costs associated with having to seize animals from a breeding facility where a valid complaint is filed. And again, keep in mind that the only way I or law enforcement is going to hear about these cases is if a complaint is filed, and that's usually after a problem is observed and if someone contacts the authorities. Current law specifically states that expenses related to cruelty cases shall be paid by the county. This incentivizes the county to overlook the problem or push it on to local humane societies. And these cases are too frequent, too costly for animal humane societies to continue burdening these costs. This bill's intent to regulate the industry to the extent that ensures sound, healthy animals. And I truly urge your support, Senate File 36. And I'll take any questions throughout the debate here. If they're necessary, I'd be happy to help.
Thank you, Mr. Streff. Any questions at all? Okay, seeing none. Thanks again.
Mr. Chair, I believe there's some photos. Maybe the page has them to hand around. It's if they could do that, photos of some of the animals.
I guess the photos are already included in the packet.
They were separate, I thought. Maybe not. Oh, they were, okay.
Okay. And next, Mr. Tom Peterson. You can state your name and position for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. Very briefly, Farmers Union supports Senate File 36. I wanted to share with you that we've been part of this discussion. I was told it's been 7 years, and we've been a part of working on this legislation, both from concerns from our members about some of what you heard Mr. Streff said and out in the rural areas and the need to do something about that situation. And also, we also have breeders that had concerns, and so we've taken our, you know, the time to get involved and be a part of this bill. And we also had concerns about did it have further, would it have further impact on animal agriculture or livestock, and always felt like this bill was specific to dogs and cats. And appreciate Senator Marty's work on this bill and urge your passage. Thank you.
Thanks. Any questions for Mr. Peterson? Seeing none, we'll move on to Dr. John Bailey. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Dr. John Bailey. I'm currently the immediate past president and board. I'm a current board member of the Minnesota Veterinary Medicine Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today in support of the framework of the bill as amended. As I'm sure we've already heard today, that this issue has been in the legislative arena for a number of years, and hopefully we're at a point where we can move this issue forward to a positive resolution. We would like to thank Senator Marty for his leadership in this issue and his willingness to assemble a group of key stakeholders in order to discuss our differences and forging a compromise of the bill that is represented in this current bill. Last session, the MVMA put forth legislation, Senate File 955, chief offered by Senator Coonan, that outlined the MVMA's position, main points of participation on this issue. The key provisions of this bill include completion of a veterinary health certificate by a commercial dog and cat breeder before an animal is sold, establishment of written veterinary protocols at commercial dog and cat breeding facilities that contain disease control and prevention, euthanasia, and veterinary care of all animals at the at each facility. Enhanced record keeping requiring, enhanced record keeping requirements of commercial dog and cat breeders, and that the Board of Health of Animal Health be the lead entity for inspection, investigation, and possible enforcement action of commercial dog and cat breeding facilities. We would like to thank Senator Coonan for authoring the MVMA bill, as we believe this bill's introduction was an important step to getting us to this point. Late last session, at the request of several legislators and the invitation of Senator Marty, MVMA participated in several meetings with the Board of Animal Health, the Pet Breeders Association, Animal Humane Society, animal folks, and other animal advocates and bill authors in crafting compromise language as is contained in this amendment, including merging the main provisions of the Minnesota Veterinary Medicine Bill, Senate File 955, into this amended version. We believe our provisions are important to ensure the animals at these commercial facilities are provided the best possible care and well-being. Minnesota Veterinary Medicine Association also strongly believes that the full funding request of the Board of Animal Health is crucial to this bill's success. We would ask for your support of the bill as amended. MVMA recognizes that this amendment may not be perfect, but we do believe that this is a great step, and it's our hope that addressing these issues it will benefit all involved. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair, and all committee members. I can take any questions that you might have.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thanks again, Dr. Bailey. Terry Franzen. Welcome, Ms. Franzen. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Terry Franzen. I'm a breeder. I've been a breeder for about 13 years, and I serve on the board of directors of the Minnesota Pet Breeders Association, and I'm speaking today on their behalf. The main focus of our association on this issue has been to work with other interested groups to find common ground to try to improve the language of this bill. In doing so, we raised many concerns with language of previous versions of the bill. Some of these concerns have been addressed, but there are still several points we are hoping to continue to work on. A few major issues are that the inspections outlined in this bill are going to duplicate the new USDA rule, which expands their inspection program to include private breeders. Also, the term commercial breeder portrays a negative image of all breeders, and that term could easily be changed to the neutral term dog and cat breeder. We are very comfortable that the Board of Animal Health has been granted the authority of licensing, inspections, and enforcement, but we want to ensure that they are also given flexibility to work with the individual breeders. Our group worked very hard to advocate for a breeder excellence program, so we are very pleased that this language has been included in the bill. We would like to thank all the groups involved. A lot of progress has been made to improve the language of the bill, and we are hoping to work with you and other interested groups to address our concerns so that as this bill moves forward, it will allow us to continue our hard work as being ethical, reputable, caring breeders. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Franzen. And yes, okay. Next, any questions at all for Ms. Franzen? Senator Coonan.
Thank you, Ms. Franzen. You know, some of the earlier testifiers talked about some what I would call real horror stories of what would happen with breeders. How widespread do you think that is in your industry?
We think
Ms. Franzen.
Oh, thank you. We believe that there are very few and far between. The vast majority of breeders are very ethical, reputable, caring breeders, and we pride ourselves on providing healthy, happy, socialized puppies to our customers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Coonan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Franzen. Within your group, do you have any method in place now to kind of watch each other as breeders to make sure that your level of performance is high enough to meet your customers would be looking for?
Ms. Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Within our group, we do a lot of educational seminars. We host a two-day seminar every year with very highly educated speakers that come in from across the country to continue to keep current on all of the husbandry and care issues. We do not have like an inspection program within our group, but most members are inspected by the American Kennel Club. A lot of our members are already inspected by the USDA, and the new rule that the USDA has put into place will inspect almost all of these breeders also.
Good. Thank you. That's
Senator
helpful.
Coonan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Franzen. Next, Ms. Kristen Smith.
She's not going to be testifying.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Elaine Hansen. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Hansen. If you could state your name for the record.
Thank you. I'm Elaine Hansen. I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Dog Clubs. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance, which also opposes this bill. I thank you, Chairman and members, for inviting us to speak to you about this bill. The Dog and Cat Breeder Licensing Bill is a proposal looking for a problem, in our opinion. None of the groups promoting these bills has produced any data that could serve as a basis for estimating that there are 475 Minnesota cat and dog breeders who would come within the definition of commercial breeder under this bill. There is not a scrap of information indicating how many, if any, problematic breeders there may be among those to be regulated. It is likely that nearly every breeder who would be licensed under this scheme would already be subject to nearly identical regulations and inspections by the United States Department of Agriculture. There seems to be agreement among all groups that there are some substandard breeders. The debate is whether substandard breeders are typical or are an anomaly. Minnesota has an effective anti-cruelty law that provides for investigation of complaints about the conditions an owner's animals are kept in. The organizations that could disclose how many complaints involve pet breeders and how many of those are substantiated have not provided that data even to the lawmakers who are seeking enactment of these bills. Those organizations are not accountable to the public in any way, so they are free to cast the shadow of abuse on all pet breeders by simply repeating a few tragic tales. Surely, lawmakers must know that the plural of anecdote is not data. There seems to be an assumption among those who support this bill that people who choose to breed pets have a propensity for abusive practices. They apparently feel that abuse just comes naturally to anyone who would choose to breed pets, so there must be dozens, if not hundreds, of them to be rooted out and shut down. They imply that pet breeders routinely abuse the animals kept for breeding and grossly neglect the very kittens and puppies they depend on as a primary source of income. But they offer no evidence for these theories, and there is not even a dab of logic behind them. They are simply sure that they are out there somewhere and that this costly licensing program is going to find them. Few Minnesotans who want pet breeders to disappear realize that they would be paying for this process twice. The United States Department of Agriculture recently gave itself the task of monitoring the activities of additional thousands of pet breeders, including those in Minnesota who would be licensed under this bill. USDA is requiring everyone who owns more than 4 intact female pets of all species combined and who ships one single pet to a buyer who does not live in their immediate community. Those people must all obtain a federal license as a pet dealer. This doesn't apply just to those who produce a certain number of litters or a certain number of pets, but to everyone who keeps 5 or more females that could be used for breeding and sells just one pet to a buyer sight unseen, in addition to those already licensed because they have wholesale businesses. If this bill is enacted, most of those who would have to be state licensed will already be USDA licensed. Some people claim that USDA rules require only the bare minimums for survival. That is false, and anyone who has actually read the several hundred pages of those rules could not make that statement in good faith. It makes no sense to pass a law that will duplicate a licensing and inspection program for an unknown number of dog and cat owners who are already subject to state laws against animal cruelty, already subject to state consumer protection laws, and are already subject to federal regulation as pet breeders. I urge you to vote against this bill because the scope of the problem has not been determined. The cost of implementing this program is way out of proportion to any problem that may exist. And the program will be a duplication of effort, as most who would need to be licensed by Minnesota will already be licensed by USDA. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. Any questions at all from Ms. Hansen? Just one question about the USDA.
Yes.
As far as inspections, do they do inspections? If so, how many? What
they do unannounced inspections at least annually, more often if they have to issue correction orders for deficiencies or if they have encountered a problematic breeder who is consistently out of compliance with the USDA rules. It's also the case that USDA inspectors and American Kennel Club inspectors are required as part of their jobs to report any egregious conditions to local law enforcement authorities. They can't just shrug them off and walk away. If the breeder is out of compliance, doesn't know how to comply, refuses to comply, they are obliged to report those for follow-up with law enforcement authorities in the community where the breeder resides.
Okay. Right. Any other questions? Thank you. Ms. Julie Gerdes. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Gerdes, and if you could state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Julie Gerdes. Thank you, committee members, for hearing my testimony today. I better leave these on.
I am here to ask that this bill be altered. I'd like to see this bill be better than it is in its current form. I'd like to see this bill to relate only to the care and conditions of dogs and cats. And I believe this bill attempts to do too much, but also it attempts to do too little. First off, Minnesota has a statute, 325, that's labeled sales of dogs and cats. There's many provisions inside this bill that relate directly to the selling of dogs and cats. I believe that those items should be placed over to 325 so that they do apply to everyone who sells dogs and cats, not just those people that have 10 or more adult intact dogs and produce six or more litters. Specifically, there's four items. One is the minimum age of a puppy or kitten. The way this SF-36 is written, only certain breeders could sell puppies and kittens 8 weeks of age at a minimum. Anyone else could sell a puppy or kitten at five, six, or 7 weeks. Another thing is a microchipping and tattooing aspect of this before selling. There's a brucellosis testing requirement for 7 months of age or older animals. There's also an expiration on health certificates that expire after 30 days, but only for those people who have 10 or more dogs and are producing six or more litters. I'm asking that that be placed under 325. Without it, they would unfairly force certain sellers or breeders to make more costly investments in the animals that they have for sale, up to possible hundreds of dollars per animals, making their animal selling costs higher and putting them at an unfair advantage in the marketplace, which plays into what the secondhand pet selling businesses want. They want to have an advantage to sell the animals in their inventories to people instead of the breeder who is raising purpose-bred puppies and kittens. Number two, I'd like you to please remove the aspect that would make it a crime for certain animal owners, but not other animal owners, that if they don't if they don't perform physical acts of affection 2 times a day on their animals, that they're going to be found a criminal. Government shouldn't be involved in how often someone shows their dog, cat, chicken, pigs, or spouse physical affection. What if the dog ticked over the garbage that day and I didn't want to pet it that second time? Would I become a criminal if I didn't pet my dog twice a day? I think that that's just something that should be stricken from this bill. This bill also institutes additional punishments for people that would have been charged and convicted of crimes who have completed their sentencing of jail time, probation, and fines by not allowing them to gain employment in the field they might be expert at. And I believe that's wrong. Aren't we supposed to be a kind and caring society and allow people who have paid their dues to society to have a second chance and to rebuild their lives? Judges are the ones that are qualified to hand down terms of punishment. This bill should not do that. Please eliminate the program of excellence. Why would taxpayers want to pay additional costs for government to create and implement a gold star program for pet breeders? This is not government's place to give an extra stamp of approval on a business. Minnesota Pet Breeders Association asked for this, and they could go and get and develop their own program to improve their reputations. They can create their own program like the American Kennel Club does with their Breeder of Merit program and the Cat Fanciers Association does with their Cattery of Excellence program. Please eliminate this from this bill. The proponents of this bill are business owners that sell pets. However, they've left themselves out of this regulation and oversight. You're seeing, some nasty pictures. I can show you nasty pictures that come from secondhand selling companies, too. I think this should be a bill about people who own multiple animals and not people who own multiple animals and raise litters. Iowa and Wisconsin has breeder licensing in place, but they also include their rescues, their shelters, their secondhand businesses in those inspections. And they do that because they want to protect all of the animals in their states, not just some. And isn't it curious that the people that want to push for this bill are leaving themselves out of it? I would suspect that honorable secondhand pet selling businesses should welcome this inspection as any honorable dog breeder should. Please ask Representative Lesch to have these dog and cat businesses added into this bill. Right now, there are current inspections being completed. However, they are sporadic, and it depends on which county you live. But AKC does inspect
members of their group, USDA does, county does, veterinarians do, and the Animal Humane Society offers inspections as well. I believe that a task force should have been or could be put together so that this is a more fair and founded bill to be introduced. And also, as far as complaints are concerned, complaints are over-reported. And the Animal Humane Society can verify that for you. It's anywhere from 25 to 30% of complaints that come in are completely unfounded. So there's already a great degree of oversight. I'm not opposed to an inspection program, but I am opposed to one that is not fair and is not applicable to everyone across the board equally. Thank you for your time. I welcome any of your questions.
Thank you, Ms. Gurdjieff. Any questions? Yes, Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Marty, could you give me some idea of the number of breeders that this bill will affect? Any idea?
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I think in the, I don't know if I have the fiscal note with me, that will be in another committee. Perhaps we can get better answer than I would.
Sure.
Mr. Streff. Up with numbers.
Mr. Chair, members, committee members, part of the difficulty is that it's a rolling dynamic. Without registration and ability to inspect these agencies, it's kind of a guesswork as to how many are existing out there today.
Okay.
Follow-up.
Yeah. Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair. And Senator Marty, can you give me any idea if there will be any exceptions, and if they are, what type of exceptions there may be to this bill?
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, the compromise that we worked out would cover only the breeders that have 10 or more adult intact animals and that are raising at least 5 litters a year. So we are, the original bill had where all, I think any over 6 or 8 or so would have to at least register with the state, no inspections or anything, but just so we knew how many were out there. But the compromise was to pull it in here just for the larger ones.
Mr. Chair, members,
I
can add on that as well. There was mention of large or medium or different size animal rescues and or animal humane societies. It's important to note that we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and we are not in the business to breed. We're in the business to take displaced animals and put them into new homes.
Any other questions? Yes, Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Marty, excuse me, the requirement in there that every animal that leaves a breeder has to have a veterinarian's health certificate. What is the cost per certificate for that to be obtained?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Streff.
It's typically $25. It's a flat fee that most vets charge. A CVI is called a certificate of veterinary inspection, but there's other individuals that might be able to go into detail on that, but that's typically the going rate.
Okay. And it's my understanding.
Senator Weber.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Okay. It's my understanding there are sometimes breeders that may have temporarily have additional animals in their facility. It may be that a certain type of dogs, and they may have bring someone else's in and what have you, and that if there may be a temporary area where they have they're in excess of that 10 animals. And now, does this allow any type of temporary thing to be a situation to be excluded, or do they automatically get covered there by that, or
Mr. Chair? Yeah, that answer is in the bill. You'll find it under Section 2, Subdivision 5, defining commercial breeder, where there's a total of 5 total litters produced per year or 10 or more intact animals.
So,
Senator Weber.
So then if they have someone else's animals there that they are taking care of for the time, those animals are excluded from that number then at that point? Is that correct?
Mr. Streff.
Mr. Chair, if they're included in the number of their adult intact breed, that would be included, that number.
Okay.
Any other questions? We do have one more person that would like to testify, Ms. Lindy Forstater. Forstater, is that correct? No?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Lindy Forstatter. George Washington and Thomas Jefferson were dog breeders. What kind of rights would they want for dog breeders? Privacy. For those of us who keep our dogs in our homes, any inspection is a de facto invasion of privacy. I do not approve of kennel inspections being done in private homes, as they are currently done in my community. The risk of a contagious disease such as parvo outweighs any benefit of sending government officials into citizens' homes. Unreasonable search and seizure. USDA currently inspects the premises of any breeder who keeps more than four female animals and sells even one puppy or kitten sight unseen. This means that virtually any breeder affected by SF-36 would already be inspected by USDA. There is no need for the state of Minnesota to duplicate the efforts of USDA. Also, the underlying motive of this legislation is to provide a steady stream of confiscated pets to animal rights groups who sell them as rescues. If an animal is allegedly abused, I believe that the last step should be to confiscate and sell a full kennel of dogs. Like Washington and Jefferson, current dog breeders deserve our respect and admiration for their efforts. They should not be emotionally and financially abused by the government taking their lifelong breeding programs away without first establishing probable cause and clear evidence of deliberate abuse or neglect. Taxation without representation. Hobby breeders with small home-based kennels do not have a lobbyist here to advance their cause. There is a lobbyist for large commercial breeders and approximately 10 for animal rights. We need lawmakers to consider our voice, however drowned out it is, by well-funded special interest groups and not simply vote yes or no based on partisan politics. In the previous meeting I attended for the House version of this bill, Temple Grandin's work with the cow was mentioned as a template of good animal management. The testifier talked about a glass wall around animal care. This is a flawed model for the dog. The dog is a denning animal that, like the wolf ancestors, requires a dark, quiet, and private setting to give birth and raise its young. The inspection process, if done at the wrong time, can cause so much stress that mother dogs turn on and kill their puppies. Respect for the natural instincts and sensitivity of dogs means minimal inspection at a time when dogs have young puppies. As a dog breeder, it is my responsibility to raise puppies that are as healthy as possible and give them a smooth transition to their new home. I do not think that the rare examples of animal abuse in Minnesota are any more common in breeders' facilities than in pet owners' homes, such as hoarding cases, or in rescues or animal shelters. Please stand with Minnesota's small breeders to oppose this legislation.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you, Ms. Forstatter. And we do have one more, Ms. Susan Black. And if you could state your name for the record, please, Ms. Black.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Susan Black, and I started getting phone calls that increased pretty dramatically right after the USDA bill came in. And I told everyone that we can no longer ship puppies. We are commercial breeders if we do that. We cannot. And that they would have to come to my home. I get probably about 5 requests a day on a regular basis. I can come home on a Sunday and have a dozen. And I've told people that what they need to do, there are states where, like in my breed, in the mid-1990s, there were 9,000 registered with the AKC every year. In the last few years, there have been about 900. Because of the kinds of legislation coming down, my breed is 1/10 of what it used to be. So people that are coming looking for pets right now haven't bought a dog for 10 years. They have no idea what the legislation has done. I tell them, you have two options. You can go to a commercial kennel. There is a large kennel right over the border for my breed in Iowa. She has about 70 dogs in cages outside. She's a USDA breeder. And there's one in Wisconsin. There aren't any in Minnesota. They can do that because they can ship, or they can go out of the country. We are outsourcing pet breeding to Canada, to Denmark. The Humane Society, the idea of the Humane Societies, I don't think people understand what's happening and how rescue gets organized. Right now, we have a bunch of dogs coming in, I guess, from India. So I told all my people, make sure all your dogs, because they're going to bring in rabies, more than likely. They're going to bring in these dogs. And this happened when Katrina happened, too. They moved diseases all the way in places in the country that had never been before. But the vans of dogs, and this is a good idea. You've got overstocked shelters. You've got a lot of hounds in the south. So they bring them up here in vans. And none of this stuff is regulated. And they sell those dogs. And you want to come into my home. Now, I fit in this category because I have a sled team. I have the last kennel license in my city. I had a litter of two over Christmas. They are born beside my bed. I have a litter of three right now. So you want to inspect, you need to come into my bedroom because they're born right beside the bed and their first parts of life are raised in there. So in part of the bill, and I don't know if it's still in there, said that every hobby breeder or something has to register. And so I've got pet people coming saying, what do we have to do? So what I'm doing right now is informing people that they need to go out of the country to import a dog or to a commercial kennel, because the number of reputable breeders is going down. For me, each dog that I have that I make a champion, probably roughly about $3,000 to $4,000 to make a dog a champion, probably another 1,000 in health clearances. The gold standard for the heart clearance is about $500. Fee to get a dog inspected and a health certificate on a dog is usually the price of whatever. At my vet, it's $55 and then $17 more to get a certificate for that. That's what it costs to get each dog done. So I don't know what to say except that the unintended consequences of what we're doing in this industry by the way we're regulating it is taking out a lot of the people that are really dedicated to dogs. The dog shows are dropping in numbers in a huge way. It's the second best attended event for adults. The biggest one is Little League. The second one is dog shows. Little kids who want a 4-H dog, you know, they call me from North Carolina, whatever. Florida, I'm sorry, there's none of my breed in Florida. You can't get anything in California. You can't get anything in Texas. We're turning them down. We're changing, you know, what is a cash flow for towns when they have these small dog shows, and we're stopping the reputable people, the people who spend all their money on all these health clearances. And I'm at that level. This bill scoops down and catches me. So I don't know if that's what you want to do, but I just, all these phone calls and all these people, it's really sad to have to say this to them. It breaks my heart.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Marty, I had missed much of the first part of the testimony because I had a bill up in another committee. And so I just wanted to, for the record, thank you for bringing it forward and let everybody know that that this bill isn't about that. This bill, you know, this bill is about the love of our dogs around this table. And so we will be watching and making sure that as we go forward and evaluating other policy in the future, that we keep in mind the very best interests of all the pets of our state. And just want to make sure that on the record that people do understand that that's what's in our hearts and minds as we determine how we whether or not we support this bill. So thank you, Senator Marty.
Are there any questions? Any other questions? And thank you, Ms. Black, for your testimony. Any other testifiers who would like to come forward? Okay, seeing none. Senator Marty, do you have any final comments you'd like to make?
Mr. Chair, as we've discussed, this is a bill that not everybody is happy with. It's been a long, hard push for a compromise to come up with a system to prevent some of the worst abuses. We're not trying to cast aspersions on all breeders. We're not trying to say anything of the sort. We're trying to get after the problems. And I think this bill does that, and I urge your support. And I think we've got a couple other committee stops after this, but I urge your support.
Sure. And the next committee is Judiciary, from what I understand. So would someone like to move the bill? Senator Weber?
Well, okay. Go ahead and have the bill move first.
Yep. Senator Rood moves that Senate File 36, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Senator Weber, yes.
You know, I'm in my second year here in the Senate, and we had a lot of this last year. Well, you know, we'll take care of things in the next committee. And I understand we have a shortened session this year, but, you know, I'm not going to vote for a bill that I feel needs a lot of work yet. And I really am coming to dislike that practice, because I think in each respective committee, we need to make a bill as good as we think it can be. And then the next committee can take a look at it and draw it apart and what have you. I understand that there are some of the parties that have come to the table and have some agreement now on this bill. I don't know if all of them are exactly enthused about it, but I just want to say that I just don't like the idea. We kick everything down the road, and in light of the fact that there's so many things that come to the last minute anyway, I don't think that all the corrections that everyone plans to make ever necessarily get made. And so I'm going to vote no today, and not because I want to see animals abused or misused, but I think that it's been admitted that there's still work that needs to be done, and we have had that admission made, and I think we send the bill back to be worked on. So,
okay. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, briefly, Senator Weber, we're not planning to do a lot more work on this bill. We've been putting on many months of work. Not everybody's enthused about it. That's true, and that's often true with compromises. We are not going, okay, next committee, now we're going to undo this and do this and change this. We've been trying to accommodate the concerns as people have listened. We've listened very closely to the Veterinary Association. We've been listening closely to people on all sides of this. I don't know that at the end of the process that the folks who are unhappy with it are going to be happy with it. My goal is not to come to the next committee and tear this all apart. I agree with you. We should try and get bills in the best shape we can get them. We've been trying. Is this my first choice? No. Is it other people here's first choice? No. But I think we've worked on a hard-fought compromise, and I think that's why you have such broad support for this.
Okay. Any other comments, sir? Senator Schmidt.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add, I've heard from folks on both sides of this issue, and I'm very sensitive to the concerns raised by this, you know, the small, you know, mom-and-pop shops, if you will. But a lot of the concern I've heard with this bill is not what the bill does, but what could happen down the road in a future legislature. And in my mind, that falls short of firm reason for opposing this bill. So I hear the testimony that was brought before us today, and folks have called my office and sent emails to us. I try to read every one of those things. I take them very seriously. But I think there's a misunderstanding between what this bill does and what the concern among a lot of folks out there is. So with that said, I will be casting my vote in support of the bill, but I have heard you loud and clear on both sides of the issue, and I respect the fact that you took the time to contact us. So thank you.
Okay. Any other comments? Seeing none, Senator Rood renews her motion. Again, Senate File 36, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and the bill is passed. So thank you, Senator
Thank
Marty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Our business is done, and the meeting is adjourned.